The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it.
Beyond the Bricks with jQuery and Mike Thompson, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
Yes, indeed. It is hopefully music to the ears of everybody, but certainly music to our ears to hear that introduction and know that another year is upon us for the greatest race in the world, the greatest spectacle in racing at the world's greatest sports venue, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. My name is Jake Query. Mike Thompson, you will hear from very shortly as well. And this is indeed Beyond the Bricks. From the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, it happens. Hire Hensley. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool for another year. And hard to believe, Mike Thompson, but this is year number five for this show. And I know I speak for you, Mike, in saying what a thrill and a privilege and truthfully an honor it is for people to make comments to us and be so kind to us throughout the course of the year to tell us how much they enjoy hearing the anecdotes, the audio, and the stories of the history of the Indianapolis 500 that you put together each and every year for us to talk about.
I've been really gratified to have so many people come up to me, and I know they come up to you as well, and it feels like it grows. I don't know how you feel about it, Jake, but it feels like it's been growing the last couple of years. More and more people keep coming up saying how much they enjoy the show and stopping me at the memorabilia show or at Mid-Ohio, things like that. So I'm really appreciative and thrilled that we're about to start year number five. I can't believe this is already year number five doing this.
For those that are unfamiliar, my name is Jake Query, and I am the host of the afternoon show on this radio station at 93.5 and 107.5, The Fan. I say afternoons, midday, technically, from noon until 3, Query and Company. Mike, on the other hand, is a longtime Indianapolis Motor Speedway historian and archive collector, as well as audio collector. And Mike, this show really is based upon the incredible amount of audio and knowledge you have regarding the history of the Indy 500.
It's a lot of fun to put together the archives, pull from the archives I have and share with people. And I've collected over the years, all kinds of audio from different sources. And so it's a lot of fun for me to be able to share that with folks. And I have so many people who stop me and say, we've had people who we've played audio of a relative of theirs. And they'll say, I haven't heard their voice in, 50 years or something like that. So it really is a lot of fun to be able to do that and share with folks.
Over the course of the next month leading up to the Indianapolis 500-mile race, we will be with you each and every night. Depending on the Pacers' playoff schedule, sometimes it varies whether or not it airs in its initial installment on 93.5, 107.5, The Fan, or our sister station, 93WIBC, or on the streaming. There are times where we will be letting you know of an alternate place where you can hear it. But I think a lot of people listen to this show after the fact in archive form, which is always greatly appreciated. And Mike, since this is the first time that we have done the show since last season's racing season, talking about the NASCAR running at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in addition to doing this last May, sadly, but at the same time, somewhat triumphantly, one of the beauties of this show and one of the challenges of it from an emotional standpoint sometimes is we do take a look back on those that we have lost since the last time that we were together, which that in itself obviously has a somber tone to it. But the beauty of the contribution of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway when people make it, and the beauty of audio, obviously, and just statistics in general, is it allows us to keep alive those that were a special part of this event. And whether it be to you and I personally or just to fans in general in terms of their footprint on the Indianapolis 500-mile race. There are a lot of people that their memory is kept alive and their contribution is kept a part of what we're doing. That includes a couple that we're going to talk about tonight.
I think it's important to do that, and I think it's important to shout out those that we've lost in the community. And it's something that you do, I think it's really special on race day. I think that's a wonderful gesture you do for folks where, you know, the people can say, you know, I've lost someone, and you keep that alive. And I think that tradition, Jake, is really important. And I'm not just saying that because we're doing the show together. I think that's really amazing what you do for people. And I think it's important for us to do what we're doing, you know, to say, let's give a shout out to the folks that we've lost and honor them. And it sparks a conversation. It sparks, you know, good memories, I think, for a lot of people. And I think it's important to do.
Well, and when I do that, and that began, I appreciate that, Mike, a number of years ago, Mark Thompson was a friend of mine that lived in Kokomo, Indiana. And then my friend Kevin Turhan Donner, who lived in Austin, Texas, but we grew up together. Both were lost in the same year. And in the pre-race on the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network, which, you know, I'm extremely fortunate to be a part of, when we go around at the beginning of the race and each are asked just kind of our thoughts of the morning, I had made mention of those two individuals and then realized how much that race means to so many people and began asking, in fact, for the names from people of a loved one that they have lost since the last time the Indianapolis 500 had run. And that began part of a pre-race segment that Mark Janes is kind enough now to give me kind of its own amount of time. Unfortunately, that list, you know, each year there are those that we mention with it because that means that people are lost. But it's an important part of the history of the Speedway. And I do that from the broadcast perch of turn number three, which is a position that was held for a number of years by, I think, probably the most iconic voice to do it in Larry Henry. And Mike, before we get into Larry Henry, who passed away on April the 11th, just, you know, a couple of weeks ago, for that matter, it is my belief, and certainly this is up for debate, but as somebody who works on the radio network, and it is the ultimate privilege and honor to do so, I believe that that era where you had Bob Jenkins as the chief announcer, and then certainly in turn number one, you had Jerry Baker, turn two, Gary Lee, turn three, Larry Henry, turn four, Bob Lamy. The 1992 finish, for example, the 1989 finish. I think those guys were doing it when that network and the network that I'm a part of now was as good as any time period that you can find in radio.
Oh, I completely agree. And I mean, think about the fact that at one point, Larry Henry is in turn three, and then he's tossing to Bob Jenkins in turn four. It doesn't get much better than that as a combination, does it?
Yeah. And obviously, you know, you're talking about just the cohesiveness that that group had together. Larry Henry was born on February 7th of 1952 in Scottsburg, Indiana, and went to school at Rose Holman over in Terre Haute. Spent time since the age of 16 with his very dulcet radio voice broadcasting the airwaves in central Indiana. Columbus, Indiana, as a matter of fact, was where he began a broadcasting career that later would go to Indianapolis, would spend a lot of time in Detroit working as well for the Detroit Lions in terms of their preseason broadcast, television and radio broadcast. So an iconic radio broadcaster who spent a number of years within the IMS radio network as well as the CART radio network. But 1981, if you go back to that race, that was the controversial finish, of course, when you think about the 1981 race that we've talked about on Beyond the Bricks between Bobby Unser and Mario Andretti. But 1981 also was the rookie year of Larry Henry on the Indianapolis Motor Speedway radio network.
Leaving Howdy, they build speed again and look down a 5/8 of a mile, 50-foot wide backstretch. This open piece of track is the fastest on the race course. This year, we have a rookie position there. This Kier coming to us from Columbus, Indiana, and our affiliate there is Larry Henry. And welcome aboard, Larry.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's an honor to be a part of this great race. I'm located halfway down the back straightaway, 60 feet from the inside of the track, high atop a concrete and steel tower. To the south of the VIP suites, to the north of me, turn three. Directly in front of me, these 33 thoroughbred racing machines will reach their maximum speed of between 205 and 215 miles an hour. Much of the passing that these cars do will be here as they do wheel-to-wheel and head for turn three. It should be an extremely exciting day here on the back straightaway. And, Paul, we have our rookie stripes on our microphone as do 10 of these racers today. But shortly will be veterans of our first 500. Back to you, Paul.
Larry, we wish you the best of luck today.
And back then, of course, Mike, for those that are unfamiliar, they did have, even though he only did it for 1 year before moving to the position that he would be known in turn number three, the backstretch announcer, one that I guess nowadays we could probably still do that, Mike, but they're moving at a little bit faster pace as they work their way up that 5/8 mile backstretch.
Yeah, absolutely. That was actually a key position, as we'll hear later on Beyond the Bricks this year. We've got a couple times where the backstretch is actually very important. So that was a critical position at one point in the radio network's history. But you're right. It's a little different today with the speeds they're running.
Larry Henry would make his debut in turn number three 1 year later. It is a position on the Indianapolis Motor Speedway radio network that he held until 1995. But in 1982, when you talk about great moments in the history of the radio network, I believe that two of the great finishes from the radio broadcast call were 10 years apart from one another, 82 and then later 1992. But let's begin with that epic battle. You all know about it by now. Gordon Johncock and Rick Mears in 1982 with Larry Henry in turn number three. And this is how the conclusion of that race sounded.
It's a battle.
The Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network, Paul Page, the chief announcer, anchor that you heard leading off that clip. Ron Carroll was in turn number one. Turn two was being held down by Doug Zenk. The backstretch for Howdy Bell, and then throwing it to Larry Henry in turn number three and Bob Jenkins in turn number four. It would be a year later, after the 1982 race, where things would continue to heat up in terms of the calls that would take place in 1983. And again, Mike, one of them we talked about before on Beyond the Bricks, but Alonzo Jr., I think now, would tell you, yeah, I was probably blocking for my dad and trying to protect him from Tom Sneva, who was surging. But at the time, it wasn't about necessarily Al Jr. admitting to that, but rather a guy as a rookie on the racetrack that stood between Tom Sneva and his father, who was in the lead, and it led to, Mike, one of the great moments in Speedway history.
Yeah, and I think what's cool about this clip is both Bob and Larry kind of call it out a little bit, which is, hey, he's doing a pretty good job of blocking. And I think it's one of those great moments, because the fact that, you know, you have a son in his rookie race trying to help his dad, I think anybody can understand that. I mean, even the Tom Sneva fans, I think at the time could understand, hey, a son's going to try to help his dad. And it didn't end up affecting the outcome. I mean, it could have, but you know, Sneva had such a good car that day and Al was pushing a little bit, Big Al. So, you know, Sneva got the win that he deserved. I mean, he had come so close on a number of different occasions, finishing second multiple times. So it's great that Sneva got his victory, but it did turn out to be one of the truly great moments in the 500 history.
Larry Henry in the North End, along with Bob Jenkins, as you'd mentioned, in 1983, Al Unser Jr., Tom Sneva, and Al Unser Sr.
Little Al looks like he wants to take his dad, just can't do it, but that helps Tom Sneva stay up close. They're running right together as they go into turn four.
Well, it's either that or race strategy. I don't know which it is, but Al Unser Jr. very low on the racetrack. When they come off the turn, he's either blocking Sneva from passing or perhaps trying to make a move himself.
Well, Little Al may be helping dad as Tom Sneva comes alongside, tries to get by Little Al, but Little Al slams the door on him, Ronnie.
And he's got him. He slams him again. Has to stay in the third place. That silver bullet is right on the tail of his dad, Al Unser Sr.
And now Al Jr. and Tom Sneva have dropped back somewhat as Al Unser Sr. has picked up the pace just a little. They drop back about 10, 15 car lengths behind Al Sr. now as they go into turn three.
Two or three times we've seen Little Al slam the door on Tom Sneva and keep him from catching his dad. I don't know whether Little Al's doing it intentionally or not, but he's doing a great job of blocking.
Well, he sure is, and here they are in front of me. Al Unser Sr. is leading. Tom Sneva is dropping back just a little bit.
Maybe Little Al is trying to give his dad a whale of a birthday present as he continues to stay between his dad and the second place car of Tom Sneva. And he's doing a pretty good job, Roger Ward, of keeping Tom back a bit.
Actually, what he's doing is, as they come off of turn four and turn two, he's moving down to the middle of the racetrack. Now, that allows Sneva to do some drafting, but he is so low on the racetrack, he can't get underneath as they go into the turn.
So the scene set now for the finish of the Indianapolis 500. Stay tuned for the greatest spectacle in racing.
And, of course, Tom Sneva would get the pass and get the win. Al Unser Jr. would still make a lifetime, it would seem, at the Speedway of contending for that elusive first win to begin. And it would be 6 years later in 1989 when Larry Henry would have perhaps most his famous call, when Al Unser Jr. and Emerson Fittipaldi would battle for the Indianapolis 500 going in late in the race to turn number three. And this is how it sounded late in that race on the North End.
And we have them coming now. There's Al. There's M.O. Here's Jerry Baker.
There are three cars to work their way around. Now, Unser's got by one of them. He got by Rocky Moran. So Moran is now stuck in the between. Now, there is Fittipaldi moving around Moran in number two.
They've got slower traffic in front of them now. Al trying to get to the outside to pass M.O. right behind him. M.O. moves to the outside down in front of Howdy Bell. Moved him very close to that white line. They head for three. M.O. may have him, Larry.
They're side by side. M.O. on the inside. Al caught in traffic. Goes high. They touch wheels. Oh. Al Jr. into the wall hard. Emerson Fittipaldi keeps on going. They touched wheels. Al Jr. into the wall, and Emerson Fittipaldi will lead them back to the yellow flag.
So, that's racing, I guess. We have a winner now, most probably, moving by now, Emerson Fittipaldi, who touched wheels with Al Unser Jr., has assumed the lead, and he's past you, Jerry Baker.
Indeed he is, running down, of course, at a much reduced speed. I saw no damage to the automobile. Bob, I don't know, can you see anything in two?
In front of us, Jerry, and Emo comes by and does not look as though there's any damage whatsoever. There's one car between he and the pace car. Emerson now will coast home as they head toward three. Boy, Larry, you had one great duel there just before the wall.
Well, you knew they were coming this way. There was heavy traffic. Al Jr. tried to stay on the inside, and one of that car was going, pushing, and he had to try to get down low. They touched wheels, and he spun right into the outside retaining wall, hit it hard, rode it. Emo stayed to the inside, held the car into control. Al Jr. getting out of his car, standing along the racetrack now on the inside apron with the medical personnel there. But Al Jr. knows that's hard racing. Remember, he wanted Long Beach this way, and Al Jr. out along the side of the racetrack now. Bob Jenkins.
There was a gesture given by Al Unser Jr. as M.O. passed by on the racetrack. Al moved himself out to the white line and made some kind of a gesture too far away for me to see, but certainly some disappointment and frustration from Al Unser Jr.
Al Unser Jr., of course, would since explain that he initially had the gut instinct of going with the gesture that everybody anticipated he would use, but instead of using the infamous finger, he went with a thumb up when Emerson Fittipaldi would go by and go on to win his first of what would become two Indianapolis 500-mile races. Mike, the reality is this. Larry Henry already had stamped his place amongst the history of radio calls and great finishes at Indianapolis, but nobody knew it at that time, but they were still a few years away from him having the opportunity to call perhaps the greatest of moments that he will be remembered for in turn number three.
Yeah, he had a couple more great moments, and I love that clip we just played because I love Lou Palmer. Well, that's racing, I guess.
And Lou Palmer was the chief announcer, by the way, who had moved in once Paul Page had gone to television there in the 88 and 89 races.
Yeah, that was just a great clip because, you know, he doesn't really hide the disdain a little bit there. You know, that's racing. I guess that was a great clip. But you're right. 1992, this one is interesting. I butted a couple clips here together. One of my favorite clips coming up here in a second because of the fact that, you know, Michael Andretti dominates in 1992 and nobody passes him on the track all day at speed until Al Sr. does. And the way that Larry Henry calls that pass is one of my favorite calls of a non-pass for the lead. It wasn't for the lead. It was for second place. But that's one of my favorite calls that wasn't for the lead in the history of the radio network. Just the way that Larry Henry brings such excitement to the call. That's just one of my favorite all-time calls. And so I had to put that together with another one of his favorite calls that came a couple laps later.
It is interesting that the Indianapolis 500, I've always said, there are no fluke winners. But that's not to say that there aren't years where the best driver and best car combination may not have been the one to get to victory lane. Certainly in 1992, Al Unser Jr. had knocked on the door. Scott Goodyear was a driver that was trying to kind of recapture and relaunch his career. But Michael Andretti was the dominant car for the majority of that particular day. And as Mike mentioned, he set the table for it. Here's how it sounded with Larry Henry in turn three, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network in 1992.
Here's Larry Henry in three.
Al Unser! Al Unser has passed Michael Andretti! Al Unser now has passed Michael Andretti, the Buick powered. There's something going wrong with Michael's car. He is a lot slower than Al Unser now.
Michael Andretti is the leader of this race. Michael Andretti leads by about 27 and a half seconds now over Al Unser Jr.
Michael Andretti, I think, is well in control of this race. He has backed off to laps in the 222-mile-an-hour range. Now, remember, he has a lot more fuel on board right now, which does slow him down, but it does appear that Michael is controlling the pace, running just as fast as he needs to.
And the pace is about 221 miles an hour, and Larry, is he slowing down?
Michael Andretti, the leader, is slowing down, coming down the back straightaway. Oh, my goodness!
At Indianapolis.
And Al Unser Jr. would go on to win that race in an epic duel with Scott Goodyear that was staged because of the fact that Michael Andretti's lead went away. Al Unser Jr. would later mention the fact, would mention the fact that when he passed, as he was coming around, he thought he smelled something as Al Unser went past him, and he thought that the car of Al Unser Sr., the Buick engine, had given way, and Michael Andretti mentioned that he kind of chuckled to himself about the speed of the Buick engine, but the fact that it had overexerted itself to make that pass of Michael Andretti. Michael Andretti very shortly thereafter would realize that the smell that he was smelling was his car coming to a completion and an exhaustion on the day, setting up an epic duel to complete the 1992 Indianapolis 500-mile race. Larry Henry, again, passing away in April in Madison, Indiana, after a long and very, very successful broadcast career and, of course, life as an Indianapolis radio icon. He is not the only icon of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway that we have lost since the last time that we talked to you. As a matter of fact, one of the biggest is one that we will focus on when we return to Beyond the Bricks here on 93.5, 107.5 The Fan.
In the construction business and can't find what you need, Quality Supply and Tool has served Hoosiers for over a quarter of a century. Tom Hawk is the branch manager of the Indy location on South Harding Street.
We've always been big on keeping our shelves fully stocked of inventory of industrial-grade tools, concrete, masonry products, as well as the necessary accessories to help get the job done. You don't have it, you can't sell it. Our experience allows us to help with getting the pros as well as the weekend pro taken care of.
Quality Supply and Tool also has locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to help you think outside the box store.
The future of Harlem rests in your hands.
The MGM Plus original series, Godfather of Harlem, returns. Starring Academy Award winner Forrest Whitaker.
There's a new kid in town.
And Rome Flynn as Frank Lucas.
I'm the boss of me.
Critics rave about the rare gangster epic.
My father's planning a war.
Praising it as a great prestige drama.
Nobody plays Frank Lucas.
We will go to war.
Godfather of Harlem. Watch now, only on MGM Plus.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
They call him the fastest man at Indy. That's Parnelli Jones, who shattered his own speed record this year, qualifying at 151.153 miles per hour in the Agajanian Willard Battery Special. For the second consecutive year, Parnelli sits on the pole for the big race. This spectacular performance has made Parnelli Jones a favorite here at the Speedway. Parnelli has a favorite, too. Dependable Willard batteries. Willard's got the wallop and the stamina to dish it out when called on time after time. To quote Parnelli Jones, a battery is something like a life preserver. If it doesn't work when you need it, you're sunk. For dependability, power, and fast starts every time, I know I can depend on Willard. That's Parnelli's reaction to Willard's top performance. You'll agree during the coming hot summertime driving. If your battery's weak, have it replaced now. Always insist on Willard, the battery the pros depend on.
Sid Collins letting you know in 1963, Parnelli Jones relied on Willard batteries. Jay Query, Mike Thompson here, Beyond the Bricks. We rely on Quality Supply and Tool for sponsoring this program. We also rely on Landon Coons for capably serving as the producer here for Beyond the Bricks in 2025. As you take a look back at the names, the figures, the icons of the Indianapolis 500-mile race, and Mike, there are few that are bigger, more legendary than the man who made seven race starts at the Indianapolis 500. Of course, beginning in 1961, completing in 1967. One of the great careers at IMS and a life that also was so attached to auto racing in the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Speaking of Rufus Parnelli Jones, who passed away this past June since we last ran the Indy 500, June 4th to be exact. 2004 is when Parnelli Jones passed. But interesting, Mike, for a guy who I think probably in his racing career, which was so vast and so versatile, that is most known for his accomplishments at Indianapolis, it was another 500-mile race that he ran even before Indy that people may not realize happened chronologically as such.
Yeah, that's correct. People may not realize that he drove the Daytona 500 before he drove the Indianapolis 500. And part of that is because he had, you know, he was one of those guys that, you know, we think of baseball players as, you know, prospects, and this guy's going to be a star, or a football player, or things like that. And then they finally, you know, make it big and win Rookie of the Year, things like that. Parnelli, people knew about Parnelli, and they knew he was coming. They knew he was coming to Indianapolis. It was just a matter of when. And when it was he came, he was going to probably be the Rookie of the Year. And people were talking about him for years before he actually even came. And he had opportunities to come earlier, and it just wasn't the right fit. And finally, when he did come to Indianapolis, he was co-Rookie of the Year. But you know, he was one of those guys that you know, he actually drove in the Daytona 500 as well.
So he came to Indianapolis, to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, in 1961, and then later in an interview, Mike, that you conducted, Parnelli talked about that rookie year and finally arriving in Indianapolis.
I had an opportunity to come a year or two, actually 2 years I could have came, but the cars that I was offered, I didn't feel were, you know, worthy of what I wanted to drive. And I thought, well, I'll just wait till I get a good car, a good chance, and that's why I did it. When I first got here, you know, and did so well, I thought, well, gee, maybe I should have come sooner, because these guys put their pants on just like I did, and I found out that I was capable to be as competitive as I was with them at the beginning.
And of course, in 1961, Parnelli Jones in that particular race would start fifth and would finish seven spots right below that. He was the co-rookie of the year after that 12th place finish along with Bobby Marshman. Then he would come back in 1962, and that's when things really started to come together for him, as if they had not in what seemed to be, although it wasn't, an effortless rookie campaign. In 1962, he would, of course, start on the pole, and that was one of a couple of front row starts that he would make. It was obviously one of two poles that he would win at Indianapolis. And in 1962, he had the opportunity to win the race. One of the things that the guy that you hear on this program, Mike Thompson, talked to Parnelli Jones about in one of the many interviews that was conducted with Parnelli.
62, I know when I interviewed Roger Ward once and I introduced him as the winner for 59-62, he said, well, Parnelli probably really won in 62.
Well, I was really long gone. I mean, of any race, as much as the Turbin, any race I should have won would have been that one, as well as the Turbin car. But, you know, I could have been a 3- or 4-time winner as well, but I only ran here 7 years and finished second once the year Jimmy Clark won in another Lotus. And so I've had a great career here, and I think if I'd have stuck around, you know, I might have got hurt, or you never know what the end results are. Not that I retired or anything like that. I just decided to quit running open cockpit cars, and that's when I drove the Trans Am and the off-road and stuff like that.
Mike, another guy that would drive about anything that was a competitor in the same era, and certainly perhaps the most successful driver in terms of longevity, certainly at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, was A.J. Foyt. And A.J. Foyt and Parnelli Jones probably will forever be linked to a lot of people, as when you think of one, you think of the other. And the reality is they had a relationship that was both competitive, it was friendly, it also had all kinds of dynamics that took place throughout its evolution at IMS.
That's correct. And they had a really interesting relationship. They were very close friends. And actually, Parnelli saved A.J. Foyt's life at one point. A.J. had a bad accident at Riverside, and the doctors told Parnelli, you know, don't go up there, he's dead. And Parnelli went up there anyway, and he just realized that A.J. had some, like, dirt and, you know, got some stuff in his mouth, and he started like scooping the dirt out of his mouth. And then AJ started breathing better. And, you know, AJ was hurt in the accident, but he, you know, obviously lived, and he's, you know, still alive and kicking and fighting bees and all these different things that he does, you know. So they had a great relationship, but it's, you know, it's fun when you ask, I asked AJ Parnelli a couple questions about how basically they had always been friends, and he was kind of quick to correct me one time. And he's, you know, in this clip we're about to play, he's like, yeah, we actually weren't always friends for a few minutes. And I got a big chuckle out of that.
Here is Parnelli Jones on his relationship with A.J. Foyt.
We had a midget race at Ascot in California, and it was in the trophy dash. And anyway, I don't remember what happened. I was trying to get by him or something, and he spun me out. And so I went back in the pits, and I told my mechanic, I said, that's it. I ain't talking to that sucker again. I don't want nothing to do with him. Blah, 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 you know. And so right before the main event, I was down adjusting the torsion bar on my midget, and this body comes hugging me from behind, and it was AJ, like a big huggy teddy bear. And, you know, how do you stay mad at somebody like that? So,
of course, in 1963, Parnelli Jones would have a dominant performance at the Indianapolis 500-mile race, a guy who had led so many laps and had been so good at Indianapolis in the totality of his career. That lone win, he led 167 laps, of course, in 1963. And Parnelli Jones, with Sid Collins on the call, got his chance at victory lane in the Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Pat Badan has the white flag out, and he is
getting set to wave it for Parnelli Jones. Pick him up on the number one turn, Bill Frosch.
And here he comes into the number one turn, riding fairly low, following his usual pattern, coming up high and shooting down the short chute to Howard Bell.
Yes, we can see him now, and he's right down to that white line on this lap, too, as he streaks through here, right up onto the back stretch, and in just a second or so, Bernie Herrmann should be able to see.
Okay, Howard, here comes Parnelli now, the Torrance man from California. White helmet, blue visor, and I'm sure he's going to be a very, very happy guy. And down to you, Mikey Hurd.
Okay, Bernie, we've got it. Here comes Parnelli Jones. He's fast as he gets around me here by Roger McCluskey. McCluskey spins there in the corner. Hold it. We've got one car going around him. He's sideways, the same spot that Eddie Sachs was. McCluskey right there. He's okay. He's sitting in his car. The cars are coming around him. We'll follow. See if it's all right. They're all going on the inside. McCluskey halfway through the turn, sideways, the exact same spot where Eddie Sachs was just a few minutes ago. Now they're running under the yellow flag. Jones went around us a moment ago. McCluskey passed him on the...
And there's the checkered flag for Parnelli Jones, the winner of the 1963 500-mile race. Parnelli Jones from Torrance, California, wins the 500.
And that's how it sounded when Parnelli Jones would put his place as if he needed, Mike, the checkered flag in order to become one of the immortals at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. But winning it does exactly that. And oftentimes, Mike, it's a matter for a guy to break through of just getting in the right situation, the right car, the right feel, all the combinations that can make a guy realize that it is going to be his day at Indianapolis.
That's right. You know, it's funny. I said this to his good friend, Steve Shunk. He was very, very close to Steve Shunk, who I know you know as well. And it's kind of funny that I think sometimes Parnelli is more known for the turbine, which I know we're going to talk about later, but he's more known for the turbine than the car he actually won with. But he had an unbelievable relationship with Calhoun. And I talked to Parnelli multiple times about Calhoun and said, you know, it's almost like slipping into an old glove for you with Calhoun. And he said, yeah, he said basically it was just, it was, it almost fit him perfectly, like a glove or a shoe or something like that. And he was just beaming every time he would get back in Calhoun to drive it as, you know, one of those ceremonial laps before the race or something like that.
Parnelli Jones talking about that trusty roadster, if you will, the Calhoun.
The car was fortunate when I started driving for Aggie in 1961. That was the car that was available. Lloyd Ruby had driven it the year before. And me and the car just seemed to fit each other really well. I got in it, and of course I had a little trouble in my early laps trying to pass my driver's test. I wasn't running fast enough, and so Harlan Finger, the chief steward, told me, he says, I know there's something wrong for I. So he had Bob Veith and Johnny Boyd get in the pace car after 6 o'clock and take me around the track and see what I was doing wrong. I was driving in the corner pretty hard, they said, where do you back off? And I said, I drive it down there too. And they said, are you using the brakes? And I said, you're damn right. They said, well, that's your problem. I thought, well, they just been around here too long. They don't know what's happening. So the next day I come out, they said, back off at 3 or way before, just so that when you get down the corner, you feel like you're running too slow and you'll pick the throttle up sooner. I did that like that and gained like 4 or 5 miles an hour like that, just nothing. So then I picked up on that, started driving differently, and we became Rookie of the Year, co-rookie with Bobby Marshman, and led the race for 27 laps, could have won the race. Lost the spark plug, had to make a couple of pit stops that I didn't have to make, and wound up, I think, 12th the first year that I had. But anyway, come back the next year, and I had some things I was trying out, and what happened is I get a little bit sideways in the corner. Found out, God, that's work. It works out pretty good, because coming off the corner, it was not understeering. It was all freed up, and it made my following straightaway faster. So I was able to come back and qualify on the pole, and first to run 150 miles an hour, second year that I was there. And I qualified 5th the first year, and I come back and 62 was leading the race, long gone, lost the brakes. Finished the race with no brakes and no brains either. But they made a ruling, you had anybody known to have no brakes, they would, but I slowed down and all the way around. I wasn't first time. I wasn't going to come in. I was just going to run until I run out of gas because I couldn't stop. But I thought, well, I'll just back off. And when I go across the finish line, start slowing down. I did that, and they grabbed the car, hit the air jacks, put on three tires, and sent me out before I could say, I don't think I want to run anymore. Anyway, I had to make another pit stop. Did so and wound up finishing the race. Pretty good position, I think. I don't remember exactly. But anyway, I came back the next year, sat on the pole again, with a new track record, and won the race. And then 64, it caught on fire in the pits. And not the car's fault, but they pulled the thing out, and the header was running by there, ignited the fuel in the tank, and it blew up. That was the end of old Calhoun, as far as I was concerned. And that's why I named it Calhoun. So you always kind of name a car, have a name for it. So, but anyway, it was nice to go back and see old Calhoun at Indianapolis every year.
One of the real giants in the history of the Indianapolis 500. When we come back, we continue taking a look back at the great Parnelli Jones.
The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
The future of Harlem rests in your hands.
The MGM Plus original series, Godfather of Harlem, returns. Starring Academy Award winner Forrest Whitaker.
There's a new kid in town.
And Rome Flynn as Frank Lucas.
I'm the boss of me.
Critics rave about the rare gangster epic.
My father's planning a war.
Praising it as a great prestige drama.
Nobody plays Frank Lucas.
We will go to war.
Godfather of Harlem. Watch now, only on MGM Plus.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Jake Query, Mike Thompson, Landon Coons, Beyond the Bricks here. We're taking a look back on the fabulous career of Parnelli Jones. From the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, it happens, hire Hensley. And of course, he is one of those drivers we just heard won in 1963, but also perhaps known as much as anybody for heartache at times at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Goes without saying, right? He finished second in 1965, and then in 1967, the famous turbine engine probably should have been win number two for Parnelli, but it was not the case as the engine let go and he drops out in 1967.
But what's Parnelli Jones now? Ron Carroll on the number three turn. Ronnie?
As said, I must report, Parnelli Jones is almost at a halt on turn number four. He went by me clear under the white line, almost into the grass, and he's barely coasting around. Parnelli Jones in some kind of problem. Back to you, Sid.
Let's watch him pick him up on four, Jimmy Shelton.
It's unbelievable, Sid. Unbelievable. He is coasting in, and he looks like he is definitely out of this race.
I can't believe it.
I can't believe it either. I'm watching, and he is now barely moving.
And you could hear Tom Carnegie on the public address announcing to the fans that, in fact, Parnelli was dropping out. Turns out, as Parnelli Jones would tell Mike Thompson, he also was aware that the engine had let go.
It just finally, just going down the back straightaway, it just finally was went into neutral. I mean, it was like taking the car out of gear. And, of course, it was a bearing in the quick change rear end that let go. And, that one thing about the turbine car had a lot of torque. It didn't have so much horsepower, but it had a tremendous amount of torque, and it would accelerate, and being a four-wheel drive car, it would hook up real hard coming out of the pits, and I didn't need to do that, you know what I mean? I needed to just have a little common sense and take it easy going out of the pits, and the thing would have run hands down.
Mike, he also had some very poignant comments to you, did Parnelli Jones, about the disappointment of that 1967 race.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite things that Parnelli ever told me about, basically how he felt like he left something behind. It was just something that he thought he had that won, and you know, when he left, there was a part of him that he left behind that was missing. And it's just one of the most poignant comments I think he's ever given me.
Parnelli Jones on the disappointment of 1967.
Well, I can best describe that by the next, you know, I went to the banquet the next evening or whenever that, and the next day I left to drive home back to Los Angeles. And when I went to leave town, it was like leaving your house when you know you forgot something and you don't know what it is. And that feeling went on for a long time. And even when I came back the following year, I had the same feeling. And it took me a while to get over that feeling, that just like I left something there, and I did.
There's that picture of you in the spring of 68 with Andy Granatelli, where Jim Clark is in the wedge turban about a few days before Jim Clark passed away, and you're back in the turban, the 67 turban, and there's almost this look on your face like I'm in behind the wheel of this car again. You know, I mean, like, it is, it's almost like you described, like, it's like I left something back there. Yeah. You know, that trophy that's supposed to be on the back of that car, where is it, you know?
Yeah. Well, that was a real empty feeling that I had after the race. And even for the next two or three years that I came to the Speedway, it got better every year. But you get over things like that. Like losing one of your best friends or something. But
certainly, Parnelli Jones, one of the best friends of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and along with Larry Henry, a guy that left his mark on the greatest sports venue and certainly the most historic in the United States. Mike, I love doing Beyond the Bricks. We have so much fun doing it. I say, and I'm just going to make a proposal here, that each and every Monday through Friday evening between now and the Indianapolis 500-mile race, we just continue to do them. Sound good to you?
Sounds good to me. I'm in.
All right. We'll make sure Landon is in as well, and we will continue along with Quality Supply and Tool to bring you each and every evening the stories and the tales beyond the bricks of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. For Mike Thompson, Landon Coons, I'm Jake Query. Thanks so much for listening to Beyond the Bricks.
The future of Harlem rests in your hands.
The MGM Plus original series, Godfather of Harlem, returns. Starring Academy Award winner Forrest Whitaker.
There's a new kid in town.
And Rome Flynn as Frank Lucas.
I'm the boss of me.
Critics rave about the rare gangster epic.
My father's planning a war.
Praising it as a great prestige drama.
Nobody plays Frank Lucas.
We will go to war.
Godfather of Harlem. Watch now, only on MGM Plus.
Tired of spills and stains on your sofa? Wash away your worries with Anabay. Anabay is the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slip covers made with performance fabric. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Shop washablesofas.com for up to 60% off site-wide, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.